Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 257, entitled Update on the UFO Question and the Political Implications of the ET Myth. In a number of For the Record programs and in a lecture and in some of the miscellaneous archive shows that are available, I've dealt with the whole question of, quote, UFOs, unquote, and, quote, ETs, unquote. There is substantive evidence that circular and or otherwise unconventionally shaped aircraft are quite real, but they don't come from outer space, and likewise there is considerable evidence that the whole ET myth, the notion that we have been visited by extraterrestrials, the information in that regard is not only scanty, but the evidence suggests very strongly that the ET myth has been deliberately created for purpose or purposes which have yet to be absolutely determined, but which would appear to be potentially at least fascistic. Specifically, this broadcast is going to follow up directly on For the Record program number 68. This program was done in July of 1997, and we're going to follow up not only the substantive indications of the development of circular or otherwise unconventionally shaped aircraft by humans on Earth, not ETs, but we're also going to take a look at some of the potentially dangerous implications of the whole ET myth. In the interest of time, we're going to plunge directly into the first and main article that we're going to read in this program. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who researched this for us from Popular Mechanics Magazine's issue of November of the year 2000. This article is by Jim Wilson of Popular Mechanics. It's headlined America's Nuclear Flying Saucer, subtitled A Trail of Secret Documents Reveals the Startling Truth About the U.S. Air Force's Flying Disc Aircraft. This article begins with something of a recap of the cover story of the Popular Mechanics issue of July of 1997, accessed in the aforementioned For the Record program number 68. It deals with U.S. development of circular aircraft, following up on technology that had been conducted by the Axis powers of World War II, or that had been researched by the Axis powers of World War II, as being of anti-aircraft utility during the closing phases of the Second World War. Once again, from Popular Mechanics issue of November of the year 2000, this article by Jim Wilson, America's Nuclear Flying Saucer. It begins as follows. In 1949, the biggest black hole in the universe wasn't in space, but across the Bering Strait. Stretching across 12 time zones, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was, as Winston Churchill would so memorably describe it, quote, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, unquote. The few things that most people knew about life behind the Iron Curtain seemed to be pieces of an incomprehensible puzzle. For the handful of intelligence experts who saw how the pieces fit, the, quote, workers' paradise, unquote, presented a clear and present danger to the American way of life. What the intelligence community knew, and most people did not, was that in the final frantic hours of World War II, the Soviet Army had hastily raided Germany's most advanced weapons research laboratories. And on August 29, 1949, only 4 years after Hiroshima, the technological booty from these raids turned a country whose farmers still used horse-drawn plows into a nuclear superpower. By the way, I would add that's something of an exaggeration or a distortion. In fact, the development of the Soviet nuclear weapons had comparatively little to do with what they gleaned from the residua of the Third Reich's weapons research programs. They got other aspects of their nuclear technology from that residua, as we did, but not their nuclear program as indicated here. But continuing with this nonetheless very important article, the fireball of the communist atomic bomb cast a sinister new light on an event that previously seemed quite inconsequential. In the summer of 1945, unusual rumor had begun to circulate within the intelligence community, with the intelligence division, of the European Command. During interrogations, captured German aircraft engineers referred to an extraordinarily fast rocket plane under development at a secret base in Bavaria. Unlike the Messerschmitt ME-163 rocket planes that had begun to attack Allied bombers in the last months of the war, this aircraft had an odd-looking curved wing that blended into its fuselage. The aerodynamic advantage of this configuration had been known to American designers for more than a decade. It created more lift than a standard wing, especially at low speeds, and provided more internal capacity for carrying bombs. In the early days of the war, the U.S. Navy had briefly experimented with circular wing design for those very reasons. Anticipating that the first generation of communist atomic bombs would be as heavy as those America had dropped on Japan, it seemed reasonable to U.S. defense planners that the Soviet Air Force, which then lacked a nuclear bomber, would try to adapt German disc technology. The United States was, after all, doing exactly the same thing with the V-2s, and Nazi rocket scientists had spirited away in Operation Paperclip. And next, the article discusses their cover story from July of 1997, which dealt with the aftermath of Project Paperclip as applies to the development of U.S. so-called UFOs. Continuing. In our July 1997 cover story, Roswell Plus 50, Popular Mechanics detailed how Air Force interest in duplicating Nazi technology led to two American flying disc projects. Project Silverbug sought to build a vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. Project Piwacket was to create small discs for use as air-to-air missiles. Documents classified since then point to a third secret project, a 40-foot flying saucer, unquote, designed to rain nuclear destruction on the Soviet Union from 300 miles in space. The official designation for America's nuclear flying saucer was the Lenticular Reentry Vehicle, or LRV. It was designed by engineers of the Los Angeles Division of North American Aviation under a contract with the U.S. Air Force. The project was managed out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, where German engineers who had worked on rocket plane and flying disc technology had been resettled. By the way, in the July 1997 issue, there was also reference to the Wright-Patterson project, and the project Silverbug and Piwacket appear to have been far more successful than one might gather from the brief mention of those projects here. In particular, Freedom of Information Act documents obtained by Popular Mechanics indicate that Project Silverbug had flown, or a prototype had flown, and had far exceeded the contemporary performance of most aircraft. That, as I speak, in the year 2000, and this was by the late 1940s. Note also that some of the German military experts who had worked on rocket plane and flying disc technology had been resettled at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in order to work on this particular project, which is indicated is indeed an outgrowth of some of the German military technology and anti-aircraft technology developed during the closing phases of World War II, as indicated in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire. Time permitting, I will give you the address, etc., for Spitfire during the latter part of the broadcast. Continuing with the Popular Mechanics cover story from November of the year 2000, the Air Force's America's nuclear flying saucer. Continuing. The LRV, that again is the nickname for the project, standing for Lenticular Reentry Vehicle, the LRV escaped public scrutiny because it was hidden away as one of the Pentagon's so-called black budget items, that is, a secret project that it has incorporated into some piece of non-classified work. On December 12th, 1962, security officers at Wright-Patterson classified the LRV as secret because, quote, it describes an offensive weapon system, unquote. The project remained classified until May of 1999, when a congressionally mandated review of old documents changed the project's status as a government secret, downgrading it to public information. The Department of Defense did, however, successfully seek to have the document's distribution restricted to defense contractors. Popular Mechanics obtained its copy as the result of a Freedom of Information Act request, and the following discussion of the performance and engineering specifications of this particular aircraft is quite detailed and perhaps not all that interesting to some members of the listening audience. I'm going to read this in its entirety because these specifications are taken from the Freedom of Information Act documents upon which this Popular Mechanics article is based, and so by way of giving listeners a more substantive evaluation of this article so that they can form a more intelligent critical opinion, I'm going to read the details from the Freedom of Information Act documents, and bear in mind that in December of 62, these were classified top secret because they described a, quote, offensive weapon system, unquote, and even after May of 1999, when they were downgraded to public information, the Department of Defense successfully, according to Popular Mechanics, sought to have the documents' distribution restricted only to defense contractors. Continuing. This next section is called Inside the LRV, and it quotes from the FOIA documents. The operational mission design is 6 weeks duration at a nominal orbital altitude of 300 nautical miles with a crew of four men, unquote, according to the report. The weapons bay would hold, quote, four winged weapons, unquote, that could be either launched or detached and parked in orbit. There are repeated references to the LRV launching weapons-carrying clusters. A considerable part of the design study focuses on the details of building a 40-foot diameter airframe and strengthening it against the acceleration of 8 Gs and wind shear it would experience during launch. However, no mention is made of the type of booster the disc would ride into space. Most likely, the LRV would have flown atop a multi-stage rocket like the Saturn booster used in the Apollo moon program. The engineering study, however, suggests a more intriguing possibility. At some point, the LRV could have been powered by one of the nuclear rockets then under development by the Air Force and the Atomic Energy Commission. Several of these rockets were in fact built and successfully tested in Nevada. Although the government claims all of its nuclear rocket program records have been declassified, a search of the Department of Energy Human Radiation Experiment database indicates otherwise. Popular Mechanics has learned that 40 cubic feet of records related to the human health effects of the nuclear rocket program compiled between 1956 and 1975 are stored in a secure location, Building 1001, at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in Los Alamos, New Mexico. A Department of Energy spokesman told Popular Mechanics that the only reason these records would have remained classified was if they dealt with an operational military system. Note that. Continuing, the four-man crew would ride a wedge-shaped capsule built inside the LRV. The capsule would divide the front portion of the disc into separate work and off-duty areas. The nuclear-tipped rockets would be stored in the rear segments. Although these rockets were not called Multiple Independent Reentry Vehicles, or MIRVs, MIRVs, they matched the description of these multiple warhead delivery devices, which were later banned by disarmament treaties. An MIRV-equipped LRV would have been able to eliminate the war-making capabilities of the Soviet Union, China, and North Korea at the push of a button. In normal operations, the capsule would function as the LRV's flight control center. In an emergency, the crew could fire the capsule's independent 50,000-pound thrust solid-fuel rocket motor and return to Earth. The capsule's final descent would be slowed by a parachute, much like the X-38 lifeboat planned for the International Space Station now under construction. A textbook mission would conclude with the entire LRV returning to Earth. It would fire its nuclear or liquid-fueled main rocket to brake, then travel edge-first into the atmosphere. Its disk form would dissipate the heat of reentry, then act as a wing. Its flattened tail structure would provide directional stability and control. A minute or so before landing, skids would extend and the LRV would settle into a stretch of dry lake bed. The engineering study does not describe how the LRV, which would weigh just over 17,000 pounds without its crew, weapons, fuel, and stores, would then have been returned to the launch pad. One possibility suggested by the inclusion of a high-pressure helium storage tank is that it would have been ferried by a heavy lift balloon, as shown in the drawing on the opposite page. While the LRV would not have had sufficient helium to inflate a balloon, the tank would have had sufficient capacity for replenishing the lift bag to permit trips of several thousand miles. In 1997, as part of its effort to debunk the Roswell alien landing myth, the Air Force revealed details of several heavy lift balloon research projects. Among those were experiments in which 15,000-pound payloads were lifted to 170,000 feet. While not specifically acknowledging the LRV by name, an Air Force spokesman conceded that during the Cold War, it routinely used high-altitude balloons to lift unusual airframes for aerodynamic tests. Airframe tests of secret planes were most likely the cause of still unexplained UFO sightings. And a balloon-lifted LRV test flight would certainly match the classic UFO reports of a silvery disc hovering motionless in the sky, then silently shooting upward. In addition to the eyewitness account presented here, albeit anecdotal, there are other indications that this project was, at least to a certain extent, realized. Not only the fact that the project was classified top secret in December of 1962 because it described an operational offensive weapon system, in the aftermath of the declassification of those documents, one expert said that the only reason they would have been classified in the first place was that if they referred to an operational weapon system. One eyewitness claims to have seen a device similar to the LRV in the late 1960s, and there are other indications that the LRV, or at least a prototype, might very well have flown. And again, bear in mind the genesis of this type of aircraft, to a certain extent originating with the anti-aircraft experiments of the Axis powers, Nazi Germany in particular. During the closing phases of World War II, some of the people who had worked on those projects then brought back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to work on the LRV and other related projects. Some crash debris obtained in areas where secret experimentation had been done on American and British nuclear weapons delivery systems also indicates that LRV may in fact have been built, or a prototype at least may have been built. The next section of the Popular Mechanics article from November of 2000 is entitled Crash Debris and reads as follows. The engineering study obtained by Popular Mechanics contains language that describes a re-entry heating test that at the time could have been accomplished by only a high-altitude drop of a flying prototype. A further indication that the LRV flew comes from a retired Air Force contractor. He tells Popular Mechanics he personally saw a craft fitting the description of the LRV at a Florida base that he had been visiting on unrelated business in the late 1960s. However, what is by far the most compelling evidence that the LRV or a flying prototype was actually built comes from Australia. In 1975, Jean Fraser found an odd bit of honeycomb-like debris on her family's ranch south of Brisbane. The area is in the vicinity of what was then a secret Australian test range where the British and Americans conducted some of their most secret atomic experiments. Since the LRV was to carry a small nuclear reactor to provide electricity for flight systems, it is conceivable the tests would have been conducted at this isolated location. I would add it was, in its conception, a delivery vehicle, a launching pad, an orbital launching pad for nuclear weapons, which is yet another reason why, in fact, this Australian site might have been the site for testing. Continuing. Local legends claim the honeycomb was debris from a flying saucer that exploded over the test range in 1966. The remaining pieces were supposedly collected by the military and returned to the United States aboard a U.S. Air Force plane. Interested in learning if the debris was extraterrestrial, Dick Smith, a Sydney businessman, arranged for the University of New South Wales to perform a chemical analysis. The debris contained minerals commonly found in aircraft-grade fiberglass panels. Based on the university's report, the MUFON UFO Journal, the monthly magazine of the Mutual UFO Network, debunked rumors of the debris having any alien origin. The concluding section is called Unexplained Residue, and from this information, Popular Mechanics draws the hypothetical conclusion that some strange residue indicating a high-temperature explosion on this honeycomb debris may very well have obtained from a particular type of fuel spillage which was characteristic of some of the prototype rocket aircraft deriving from the Project Paperclip, or the operations which gave rise to Project Paperclip. In particular, the ME-163 rocket plane developed by Nazi Germany, some of whose research experts were part of the Wright-Patterson Dayton, Ohio research team. The concluding section of the Popular Mechanics article reads as follows. Popular Mechanics became interested in revisiting the Australian debris analysis when we noticed a similarity between a photograph of the mystery honeycomb and a cross-section diagram in the LRV engineering study. We put the two images next to each other on page 68. Let us know what you think. We were also curious about two points that were raised in the university's chemical analysis, but not pursued once it was determined that the debris originated on Earth. The first has to do with the presence of small amounts of titanium. Titanium is a strong, lightweight metal used extensively in spacecraft. While some fiberglass products also contain titanium, it is not in the chemical form found in the debris. The second curiosity has to do with chemical residues. Those found on the honeycomb were similar to those typically found in the vicinity of high-temperature chemical explosions. A possible explanation for such an explosion can be found in LRV engineering drawings. Like the German ME-163 rocket plane, the main engine of the LRV was designed to burn hypergolic fuel, highly reactive fluids that can explode on contact, releasing tremendous amounts of energy. Plans showed that the LRV would have carried 9,375 pounds of nitrogen tetroxide and hydrazine. In Germany, landing ME-163s were plagued by onboard fires caused by the sloshing of a type of hypergolic fuel in mostly empty fuel tanks. According to the design study, the tanks aboard the LRV could never be completely emptied either, making accidents like those aboard ME-163s all but inevitable. LRV project managers would have been well aware of this unique danger, as one of the members of the Wright-Patterson Aeronautical Research Team was Rudi Opitz, O-P-I-T-Z, one of Germany's first ME-163 test pilots. LRV documents released thus far tell only part of the story. but in time. The secrecy on progress reports, construction drawings, and perhaps even operational records will expire, and we will be able to tell the rest of the story. Perhaps they will reveal that the LRV remained a general's pipe dream, a multi-million-dollar paper plane that never took flight. Or they may tell the story of the most astounding adventure in the history of flight. One of the reasons that I've become so interested in the subject of political UFOs as a political consideration is basically because, in the first place, the whole dialogue concerning UFOs has been dichotomized. It's either publicity seekers or the planet Venus on a very bright night, or else it's our brothers from space. Fact of the matter is, the Whammo Corporation has developed the Frisbee, a disc-shaped airfoil that flies. And given the fact that when radar came into widespread usage during the Second World War, the development of airframes that avoided the use of right angles in their construction and thereby were relatively impervious to conventional radars of the time became a top aeronautical research and development priority. It is therefore altogether reasonable that discs, which certainly avoid right angles in their airframe construction, would have been one of the airframes that and one of the types that were experimented with. The very firm and growing evidence of flying circular or otherwise unconventionally shaped aircraft in the Earth's atmosphere but built by human beings, given the fact that this evidence is being ignored and instead we're being given the brothers from space nonsense, the potential of UFOs and other types of suppressed technology to be utilized in a sinister and Machiavellian way in order to get people to bow down before a perceived extraterrestrial and all-powerful civilization is one of the possibilities that should not be too readily excluded. In this conjunction, and in the connection with past For the Record programs discussing this particular issue, we've talked about the Raelians. The Raelians are a UFO cult, and like so many of the UFO cults, they espouse a form of extraterrestrial-based totalitarianism in which the, quote, Elohim, unquote, space-based aliens that Claude Vorion, the founder of the Raelians, claims to have come in contact with, would run Earth using superior technology, and this provided once Earth's democracies and military structures were gotten rid of. Again, with the firm evidence that, in fact, UFOs are real, I think the utilization of such technologies for a deceptive form of political and social control is something we have to be on guard for. The following comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, October 12th of the year 2000. This is an article following up on the Raelians' espousal of cloning. I've also warned about the possibility of genetic engineering and the creation of new life forms, allegedly or superficially apparently extraterrestrial in origin, as a means of perpetrating a form of very devastating hoax on the human race. By the way, the Raelians symbol has been changed. It was originally a Star of David with a swastika inside, a very unlikely symbol for an extraterrestrial civilization to have used. But this extraterrestrial civilization, or allegedly extraterrestrial civilization, has some very totalitarian and fascistic overtones. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got the following, again from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, October 12th of the year 2000. This is an article by Tom Abate, A-B-A-T-E or Abate, I'm not sure how it's pronounced. It's headlined, Leader Emerges for Disciples of Human Cloning, and it reads as follows, of Claude Vorion and the Raelians. A French cult leader who has revealed plans to clone a human being visited San Francisco to say his experiment will help gay couples conceive. Rael, R-A-E-L, a race car driver turned prophet, offered no proof of his claims, which have made headlines in the Washington Post and Britain's Guardian, that an anonymous American couple has offered his sect more than $1 million to clone their dead daughter from a preserved cell sample. Margaret McLean, director of the Markula Center for Applied Ethics in Santa Clara, and a member of a state commission looking into the cloning issue, said the practice is illegal in California. Quote, because so much of this is occurring in the private sector, we don't know the state of the art with cloning, McLean said, adding that, again quoting, with adequate funding and scientific prowess, it is technically possible, unquote, to clone a human. Rael, who has set up a website, cloneaid.com, to call attention to his venture, was vague about details of the project, saying only that he has lined up a French scientist and 50 female followers to serve as egg donors. Rael brushed off questions about where, when, or how this cloning would take place. He also declined to discuss the ethical implications of the experiment, which would produce many defective embryos even if the experiment ultimately proved successful. Instead, accompanied by 3 male and 2 female followers wearing the star-shaped symbol of his sect, Rayl used yesterday's news conference to explain his belief that an alien race created all life on Earth in a DNA experiment 25,000 years ago. He said this revelation first came to him in 1973 when an alien ship landed in central France and a representative of an alien race called the Elohim explained what Rayl argued is the true story of creation. Forget the begats of the Bible and the fossils of evolution. Rayl has convinced some 50,000 followers in dozens of countries with the largest concentrations in Japan, France, and the United States that the Elohim found Earth devoid of life and created all the plants and creatures we see through vast genetic engineering experiments. Rayl said cloning a human infant from the cells of the deceased child is only the first step in his ultimate plan. Eventually, he wants to develop an accelerated growth technique which he witnessed among the Elohim. This would allow a clone to be grown to adulthood quickly. With advancing computing technology, he said, people could ultimately imprint their memory patterns on the clone's blank mind. We can reach eternal life through cloning, Rayl said. The man formerly known as Claude Vorion said he had stopped in San Francisco on his way to Laguna Seca Raceway in Monterey, where he plans to drive a car in a race. That apparently not the human race under the circumstances. I would note that in, among other programs, a broadcast called Plan 9 from Berchtesgaden, we deal with a New Age phenomenon called the Nine, which purported to be the origin of all life on Earth and the gods of Egypt, and claimed again that all life came from outer space, which is one theory that spores from outer space may have come here on a meteorite. As I've mentioned in past broadcasts, I think we have to be alert for the use of genetic engineering, unconventional types of aircraft, and other forms of suppressed technology to get us to bow down before a perceived Elohim manifestation or some perceived visit from another world. I'm going to conclude with another article researched for us by a listener. This comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, September 25th of the year 2000, talking about the use of genetic engineering to create new life forms, some of which could be misrepresented as alien. We have the following article. This is from Bioscope by Tom Abate, or Abate, again, the Chronicle science writer. This is headlined, News Stories About Tinkering with DNA Miss the Big Picture. Subtitled, Glowing Rabbit Shows We're Creeping Toward Redesigning Human Life. Consider the following, skipping down. Then there was the story about the artist who persuaded a French laboratory to splice fluorescent genes from a jellyfish into a rabbit embryo. The altered embryo was planted in a female rabbit, which gave birth to a bunny that glows in the dark, just like a jellyfish. So again, I think we need to be extremely careful of allegedly otherworldly phenomena, which in fact come from this world and which are going to be used to put people on their knees in a state of supplication and, if need be, absolute subservience and terror. I've alluded to other broadcasts on this subject available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And the website for Spitfire, which has a list of and description of the various programs available from Spitfire, that's available at www.spitfirelist.com. One word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com, and it's equipped with real audio. That concludes For the Record program number 257, this being recorded on October 22nd of the year 2000. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.